come in the kitchen, and I knew something was going on, and I'd listen, and I quickly determined that my father was going somewhere. He was going on a trip. So the next day, my father was gone. He presumably gone off to work as he did every day. And I asked my mother, where's Pa? And she said, well, he's gone on a trip. But he... And I said, when's he coming back? Oh, he'll be back soon. Well, today? No. Well, he'll be back in a few days. Well, a few days went by, and I said, yes, Pa. And she said, well, he'll be back. You know, he just went on a trip. And this went on for days, and I kept asking where my father is. Because there were times when he would not be home for a night. I don't know why, perhaps he worked late, and I just didn't see him, but in any event, this was in itself not so unusual, except that so much time had gone by, and my mother kept saying that he'll be back, he's just gone on a trip, and he'll be back. And finally, it was obvious to me that my father wasn't coming back. And I said to my mother, he isn't coming back, is he? And I was, and she said, no, he's going to America. And I was just furious. I was so angry. And, you know, in all of my life, I think I've never really forgiven my mother for that one single thing.
To did.
And, you know, many years went by before I really began to appreciate how difficult it was for my mother to accept the fact that my father had gone off, and how difficult, therefore, it was for her to acknowledge this to me, because her own pain was really reflected in the pain that she knew I must feel. And so she was trying to protect me, just as she was, in a sense, trying to protect herself from this thing, which was very difficult for her.
It's long history for immigrants of wives and children being left behind and never coming to America.
Well, that's right. And of course, she never knew. I guess in her heart, she may have felt some uncertainty herself as to whether this would ever happen. But I think more than that, it was the pain that she was trying to protect me from that she herself felt. So she never prepared me for it, and she undoubtedly has not prepared herself for my father leaving. But it really colored, in a very important way, it really determined my relationship with my mother. Because even though there were times when there were good times between me and my mother, I never had that closeness that children should have to their parents, because I didn't quite trust her. And there were other incidents that are similar to that. For example, when we left, my mother never prepared me for leaving Poland, and I didn't want to go. So she said, "We're going." Where are we going? Well, I'm going to America. I said, I don't want to go. And I was really terribly, terribly upset. And to make my passage a little easier, I was given a toy. It was a game. It was similar to the kind of board games we have today, where you roll dice and you move a little piece around. And this was a sort of a serpentine path. And my mother tried to distract me by having me play that game on a train, because we took the train from Warsaw to Danzig, where we took a boat to London, where we took a boat to the United States.
How long did that trip take?
I don't know. It must have taken a week or so. I remember that trip very well also.
Let me back up just a little bit before you go on about your religion in... Or were you Orthodox? Did you go to the synagogue in Poland?
My father was a confirmed atheist. As he put it, he used to describe the hater he went to
in Russia where he got his elementary education. He said the kids were lined up in chairs and stools and desks on both sides of a center aisle. The rabbi would walk up and down the center aisle, and he had a ruler in his hand.
That's right.
And all they had to do was memorize certain things. And they all chanted in unison, and a rabbi would go up and down listening to what they were saying. And anybody who got it wrong, he would simply whack across the hand or across the face with a ruler.
That was true in the United States.
Yeah.
Yes, of course. But this, because this, in my father's mind, was associated with religion, he got to hate religion.
So you didn't have any religious training? Then?
Not at all.
But
I
you had a grandfather who prayed all the
That's
time.
Right.
No, my grandfather. My grandfather prayed all the
yeah,
time.
Yeah, right. That's what she said. Yeah.
None of that rubbed off on
me. None of it rubbed off on me. Because he prayed in private. I mean, he would go off in his little corner.
But he never talked to you about, you know, the religion?
No,
or
he never
that
did.
That must have been a kosher home.
I'm sure it was. I'm sure it was, because my grandfather would not have tolerated anything other than kosher, and my mother, of course, was raised in an Orthodox family.
So,
but my mother was not Orthodox either.
That's interesting.
I think she may have been influenced by my father, or she may have been reformed in her own way. She had her own reformation.
Yeah.
Whatever the case, my mother, we never had any religious practices at home in the United States. But that's not true of Poland, because in Poland, because my grandfather was religious, we did observe religious holidays. And I remember my Passover, we had a fairly large apartment, but the Passover services were because there were seven children in the family, and they had nieces and wives and, you know, spouses and so on, it was a pretty big family. For Passover, they all convened at my grandfather's house, and the Passover services were held in the attic of the building. We lived in an apartment building, and the attic was a full-size attic. I mean, it was a big attic. And the table consisted of boards laid out across what we would call sawhorses. And I was the youngest male, and at the age of four, I was asked to recite the four kashas. So I sat next to my grandfather.
And they changed the dishes for Passover.
Oh, yes, of course.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that?
I remember that we had a dining room that was separate from where we ate. The dining room had its own French doors, and it was used for special occasions, and these occasions included religious holidays, and probably, and I don't remember this very clearly, but probably Friday night, Saturday too. And it was undoubtedly there that the kosher dishes were kept, and probably the Passover dishes were kept there too, although I can't be certain.
But when you came to the United States and you lived in this one room of the violin maker,
yes,
there was no religious practice.
Nothing.
Not with the violin maker,
nothing.
With your family. How about the people around you?
I don't think it was a Jewish neighborhood, but I'm not certain of that. It may have been part Jewish and part. I remember some of the kids around I wasn't exactly friendly with, because they would call me greenhorn.
Oh.
And so they teased me.
And you were.
But you didn't feel any anti-Semitism at all.
No, they just teased me because they called me greenie or greenhorn.
Right.
Yeah. And I did want to play with them, but they weren't eager to play with me.
I haven't heard that expression for years.
But that lasted for 2 months, and then
yeah.
we left.
Yeah.
So that wasn't bad.
And then we're.
That's,
and
yeah.
then.
Well, I went to
you
school.
You moved to this larger apartment
then we
with
moved,
your parents.
Yeah,
and
we stayed there about a year. This was Prospect Avenue.
Okay.
And then we moved to another apartment on Home Street, where we stayed again for another year. And on Home Street, I don't know whether that was Jewish or whether it was part Jewish or kind of neighborhood. I had no friends at all on Home Street. There was one kid who was a friend of mine. They lived above us, and he and I had one. We were presumed friends. He was the only friend I had on that street. There were no kids on the street at all to speak of. There were no children on that street. I picture that street. I picture an empty street, empty
but you
people,
went to school,
empty children.
So that there
oh yes,
school
I went
children.
To school. There were school children, sure, but the neighborhood. Children, of the neighborhood children, it was only one with whom I had anything to do with, and that turned into a rather bad circumstance. He found a little dirty book. Oh. In those days, they had these little cartoon books. They were dirty books. And he found it, or he got it somewhere. He gave it to me to look at. So I was going to return it to him. Well, how do you return it? We're going to return it the secret way. And the secret way was for him to drop, they lived directly above us, so he dropped a line down to my house, a string, and I was to tie it onto the string, you know, tie it up on the string, and he would lift it up into his room, which was fine, except that he was caught. And when he was caught, he accused me of giving it to him, whereas in fact, it had been the other way around. Well, that was another thing. My parents wouldn't believe me when I said that. No, it was my book. Where did I get it? He gave it to me. No, that's not true.
Nowadays,
they simply wouldn't believe me.
Nowadays, all the kids have to just put the television set on.
Well, his parents, you see, stuck up for their son, who said that he was innocent. He claimed innocence, and they stuck up for him, but my parents didn't. So that was another incident. Well, we only lived there for a year. And then we moved to Rosedale Avenue. Bronx, and by that time I was 10, and from there my real life began, because all these other places were sort of interim places where we lived, and on Rosedale Avenue there were many kids, nice kids, it was a Jewish neighborhood. I went to Rosedale Avenue, I was in the grade. Now, prior to this, I should say that overall I skipped school three times in public school. And when I got to Rosedale Avenue, I was already somewhat ahead of myself. And when I got into sixth grade, the teacher said she was going to skip me again. So I thought that was nice, but I was used to it now. I'd already skipped three times. And then it turned out that the Board of Education had passed a rule that said no more skipping, whether it was the board rule or whether it was a local rule. Well, I was angry. She promised to skip me. So I went in to see the principal, whose name was Mr. Aaron Wald, and we all called him Iron Walls. So I went to see Mr. Ironborough. Everybody was scared to death of Mr. Ironborough.
We were all scared of our principals in those days.
They were scared to death of Mr. Ironborough. Well, I was angry, so I went to see him. And I said, the teacher promised me that she was going to skip me. Well, it turned out that Mr. Ironborough was really a very nice man. And he tried very hard to make me see that it was not me personally, and that there was nothing to do with it, and that this was a rule, and that he couldn't help himself. And I accepted it eventually. And so I went through grade school. But it was the one place in the Bronx, when I lived in the Bronx, where I had many friends, and we used to play stickball, which was a popular sport in the summertime. And that was lots of fun. Stickball was played with a broomstick, a cut-off broomstick, in the street. It was a version of baseball. And occasionally a window would get broken, so the police were always touring around. And when we saw the police coming, we would take the stick and drop it through one of the holes of the manhole cover. And then when the police went by, we would lift the manhole cover and somebody would climb down and get the stick, and we would resume the game. And so it was a nice, and we had seasons for everything. There was a stickball season, and there was a hockey season. Everybody had roller skates, and we would use chalk and line up the goals, and we would skate and play hockey, and there were all sorts of seasons. and then it was hanging around at night in the summertime, especially we would stay downstairs and all gather at the corner after dinner and chat.
How different. How different things are today, huh?
Yeah. Well, we had stoops. Oh, yeah. And we played stoop ball, where you throw the ball into the steps and you try to catch it. And we played Johnny on a Pony
and
all sorts of games. Yeah, it was really fun, and I enjoyed myself.
So,
where did you go to high school? Yeah.
Well, I went to Towson Harris. No Towson Harris?
How do you spell that?
TOWNSEND, and there's no dash there, Harris. Towson Harris was the first ambassador to Japan. He was the hero of Puccini's opera, the by the concubine. There was a movie called The Ambassador and the Concubine. It was made about Towson Harris. And what's this famous opera? That,
Butterfly.
Butterfly, that's right. He's the hero of Madame Butterfly. And those two stories, the movie, you know, The Ambassador and the Concubine and Madame Butterfly, were about Towson Harris. He's also the man who founded the first free university in the United States, and that was City College. Sometime around 1880 or so. And Towson Harris was a high school that was for exceptional children. We have, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 Nobel laureates that came out of Towson Harris. In fact, one of them, Letterman, was in my class. He was in my class at City. Towson Harris produced people like Richard Rogers, all sorts of famous people. Herman Wouk. Herman Wouk's younger brother was in the same class as mine, but he was in a January class and I was in a junior class. E.L. Dockery was there about that time. You know, they're just legions of really outstanding people who went to Towson Harris. So if you ask somebody of my generation in New York, they immediately recognize. That's where I went. It was a three-year high school. And it was taught, courses were taught mainly by City College faculty.
I thought all the high schools were 4 years then.
That's right, but this was a special school. This was a school that was not under the Board of Education per se. It was really, you might say, a prep school for City College.
And you went through ninth grade in like a junior high setup. For many schools.
Yeah, that came later.
And then you went to high school for 3 years.
Yeah, but that came later.
That came later.
This was a
three-year
school. My experience, and it wasn't so much later.
So I graduated high school when I was 16. I graduated college when I was 20.
Where did you go to college?
I went to City. And I found a job, and I eventually went to graduate school.
What did you take in City College?
In City, I majored in chemistry.
And was that was that funded, or?
City College was free.
Was completely free.
The only thing it cost me was 50 cents for a library card. And when I first entered City College, even the books were free. But they did not provide money for books, so eventually, we ended up buying our own books, because when the book got worn out, we had to buy our own. But in the beginning, the books were free too. While I was at City College, I had a teacher in chemistry whose name was Eddie Adams. I can't remember his last name now. Anyway, he had started to work at what became the Manhattan Project. Now, I didn't know about the Manhattan Project. No one knew about the Manhattan Project. But he thought I was graduating that year, and he offered me a job. The Manhattan Project was just starting at that time. I told him that I wasn't quite ready to graduate. So he said, well, when you're ready to graduate, see me. So I think 6 months went by, and I waited. I was finished with classes. I went to see him, and he told me where to go to apply for the job. And I did, and I was shown around, and this was at Columbia University. Now, I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know it was a Manhattan Project. It was very, really secret, except that it was a job, and it was an important job. That's all he told me.
What year did you graduate?
I graduated in 1943. And it was in 43 that I went there, and I went to a building that's called Pupin. Pupin was the physics building at Columbia University.
P-U-P-I-N.
And I remember I was taken around by somebody just to show me around a little bit. And I saw one room where there were several people on their haunches filling tin cans with graphite. Presumably, they would have gotten me to do that. Now, to anyone who knows anything about nuclear physics or the A-bomb, that was a very significant fact. I'm not quite sure, but Fermi may have been there at the time.
Oh.
Enrico Fermi. Just before they went to Chicago. So this was the place where it all began, at Pupin. And the person who worked with Fermi to reproduce the experiment that they had done in Europe, that Hahn and Meitner had done, that showed nuclear fission, the person who was the electronic expert was a man named Dunning, and he was still there at the time. So I really got there at a very early stage. Well, I got to work. Actually, I interviewed for the job before I was finished, when I interviewed for the job before I graduated. I remember that. And then, by the time I graduated, I was already accepted in the job. And at that point, things had changed, the project had expanded, and I went to work in a building called Havemeyer Hall, and Harold Urey, who was another Nobel laureate, was head of that project.
When did the Manhattan Project move to New Mexico?
It didn't. The Manhattan Project consisted of, there were four main centers for the Manhattan Project. It started at Columbia University, where I was. As it grew, and it grew very quickly, what happened at Columbia University was that they showed the feasibility. They showed that nuclear fission was a real thing.
Was a what?
Was real. That is, they repeated the experiments that Fermi had done in Italy, and that Meitner and Hahn had done in Germany, I guess, or Austria. Once that was shown, and they got more money, they needed a larger facility, and New York was too crowded. They were now afraid that if they do an experiment, maybe it'll blow up. So they didn't know enough, so they were concerned that it might cause damage. So they were looking for a site where they had the intellectual base, but at the same time, there was not as much danger as New York because it wasn't as dense a population. So they went to the University of Chicago.
Do you think they were aware at the time how significant this, or not how significant, but how powerful this was going to turn out?
Oh yes, they were aware of it. They knew that this would release a terrible force. How big a force, they couldn't say with certainty, but they knew that it would be bigger than anything that had ever been conceived. Later on, in fact, when they started to develop a thermonuclear bomb, just to add a little history to this, they were so concerned that there was fear that they might ignite the atmosphere and that it would, it could cause a major destruction of the earth. They thought it was, it could be that big at last. So yes, they were aware from the beginning of how serious it was. I don't know that they knew completely, fully the extent of the bomb, but they knew that it was bigger than anything that had ever been done before. But as the project grew, it outgrew Columbia, and it required a safer place. So they chose Stagg Field at the University of Chicago. And Fermi left New York and went to Chicago and organized a group in Chicago. And they built the first real experimental pile. So they were just experimenting with what we call moderators at Columbia, at Pupin. And when they showed feasibility, they decided they needed to build something bigger. They needed to build a pile. And they built that in Stagg Field in Chicago.
Did you stay at Columbia?
Yeah, I remained at Columbia.
And you worked on the project, is what you're telling us.
Right. Uh-huh. I did. And now the project was divided into two parts. The part of Columbia had to do with separating the uranium isotope that was necessary to build a bomb. And that's what I worked on. Because my background was chemistry, and that was a chemical problem. The people at Stagg Field at the University of Chicago, under Fermi's direction, were actually concerned with the process of creating a chain reaction that was necessary for the bomb. And when they finished their work and they showed that they knew how to control a chain reaction, how to develop a chain reaction, and so on, they needed a locale that was still more remote. Some place where they could actually build and test the bomb. And that's when that effort moved to Los Alamos. In the meantime, as this project developed, we at Columbia were concerned with separating the uranium isotopes. And when we developed, and that's what I worked on, you see, his name was Eddie Adler. Eddie Adler was one of the early inventors of a method for separating uranium isotopes. And I worked with him. In fact, I have a patent somewhere in the patent files, a secret patent on how to separate isotopes.
How did your involvement in this project impact your involvement in World War II?
Well, this was during World War II, of course.
Oh, yes.
And we had automatic exemptions. But the exemptions were secret exemptions. I lived in the neighborhood around City College. I lived at that time in a one room in an apartment that was owned by a couple, a very nice couple. He was Spanish and she was Irish, and they were both lovely people. Her name was Helen Healy, and she was a cousin of the guy who played the Tin Man. His name is Healy, in The Wizard of Oz, in the movie. And he was a lovely person, too. And I had a one room with him. It was within walking distance of City College, and it just turned out that I could also walk to Columbia. So it was an ideal place to live, and so I stayed there. My draft board, but the whole neighborhood.
Yeah. Did you live at home?
No, I lived alone.
When you went to City College, when you were an undergraduate?
When I was an undergraduate, I lived alone most of the time. My father had gone to Cleveland to get a job. He opened up a store there. He had relatives in Cleveland, and they suggested he come there. My mother had been institutionalized by the time I was about 11 or so. I left out a good deal of what happened there, but when I was about 11 or 12, My mother had what might be called a nervous breakdown. She was going through change of life, and she started to become very, she had bouts of terrible anxiety. She was anxious about my father. He wasn't coming home. Would he come home? He couldn't wait until, she couldn't wait until he got home that night, and went through a severe state of anxiety. My father didn't know how to deal with this, so he went to see his friend, the doctor he knew in Russia, who was one of the most incompetent men, doctors I have ever come across. I mean, I know this from my own experiences with him. My father had very little use for him, but my father had very little use for doctors in general, because the doctors that he had been familiar with, which were mostly in Russia, were incompetent people. And this is just an example of an incompetent person. So he said, there's nothing you can do, have her institutionalized.